So I really first just wanted to say how happy I am that you have the space. It's really wonderful. I was looking forward to seeing it, because when I've come the last few years, I've taught, I guess at Bastyr. Yeah, I'm not sure exactly where I was, but I was elsewhere. And it very much felt like you were all trying to make it into a really good space. And it worked. It definitely worked. But to have your own space like this, that is so beautiful and so, forget the alarm, so serene and, obviously so cared for is really a cause of happiness. Finally, I know you've been trying for this for quite a long time. And I also really want to say that it's not just a space. I think that you're really fortunate to have the teachers that you have, Tim and Tuari and Carrie. Just the integrity of these beings and the compassion and the wisdom. I think you're just in really good hands. And that's a wonderful thing. It's, I don't know whether I want to say rare, but maybe a little bit rare. So anyway, I have a lot of mudita for you, a lot of sympathetic joy. And also, I'm kind of older than everybody, and to say that I have just seen all three of them bloom and develop and come into their own over time. So it's very good. When I was thinking about what I wanted to talk about here, I'm titling this Facing the Election with the Wisdom of the Dharma, and I kind of did wonder whether anybody would want to come. Because you can just even hear the word election and just your heart sinks. But I wanted to talk about it because our hearts sink, or we're anxious, or we're feeling helpless, or all of that. And that's where the Dharma has to meet what is, has to meet conditions as they are. So I was also interested because in this particular topic, because I feel like Seattle, this area, is there a little bit of an echo? I feel like this area, Seattle, is very much like Cambridge, Massachusetts, in that people are engaged. Many of you that I have had contact with over the years, there's a sense of interest in the world and wanting to make the world a better place in whatever way one can. And that is very much like Cambridge, Massachusetts. I am a retreat teacher as well as a daily life teacher. And I believe in daily life. Obviously, I believe in retreats, but I believe in daily life, meaning that we can wake up whatever the conditions might be. And retreat conditions are really beneficial, right? But whatever condition is there in front of us is our path to freedom. All of my retreats at IMS, the title always for the last 30 years has been Your Life is Your Practice, which means that our lives are what we need to and have to practice with. And I think that the situation in the world right now, and maybe particularly the upcoming election, is something that we need to be serious about in terms of bringing the practice to. Also, I wrote an article for CIMC, Cambridge Insight Meditation Center, and newsletter article, and I wanted to talk a little bit rather than write. So this is a kind of a chance to expand a little bit on what I wrote in this article. I heard about a study not so long ago that the American Psychiatric Association was part of. They surveyed Americans. They surveyed Americans' emotional well-being. And out of those they surveyed, they discovered that 73% of Americans are extremely disturbed and anxious and feeling helpless about this upcoming election. Maybe we know this in our own lives and in our families, but to recognize that always in our personal lives, we're dealing with a lot, and sometimes we're dealing with more than a lot, and then we have the election, and we have the situation in the world to contend with as well, and it's a lot. We know that political divisions are breaking up families having a hard time talking with one another because of different political beliefs. I know plenty of people who have lost friends because of not being able to sustain a friendship with the different principles that one is finding out that really close friends have held, and one maybe has never known about that before because the friendship hasn't gone into that kind of territory. And we know, I know anyway, as a faith leader, I almost feel like a pastor or something like that of a flock, that I know that faith communities are having a really hard time of it too. Different religious communities are having a very, very hard time keeping it together and holding everyone in, because there is such an immensity of passion, an immensity of fear, an immensity of emotion. So this is why I wanted to speak with you about this, and I'm going to keep talking, but then I hope to not talk forever and have some time to hear from you, whatever reflections or comments or questions or ways that you might want to dialogue so that we can look into this together. Really, my subtitle of this talk is engagement without entanglement. How to engage without getting entangled. And this is certainly the territory of metta and equanimity. Joanna Macy said, "This is a dark time, filled with suffering and uncertainty. Like living cells in a larger body, it is natural that we feel the trauma of our world. So don't be afraid of the anguish you feel, or the anger or fear, because these responses arise from the depth of your caring and the truth of your interconnectedness with all beings." I think this is so important to keep in mind as we find our way into what may feel like somewhat new territory, to recognize that the intensity of the emotion that we are feeling is because of metta, is because we care, is because of our interconnectedness. So we don't want to judge the feelings that we might be having. We don't want to condemn the reactions that we are having. But we also have to find a way to hold them so that we don't make things worse, so that we're neither above the fray and trying to stay above it all, which spiritual practitioners sometimes desperately try to do. You know, that kind of like navel-gazing kind of caricature, right? But we also don't want to join the fray. We want to be able to contribute peacefulness to this world. We want to be able to contribute loving kindness and wisdom and different ways of seeing and holding it all, so that we are not contributing more turmoil, but so that as practitioners, we can actually help ourselves during this time and help others as well. So metta, you know, this word metta, of course, most of us have heard many times. It's almost like an English word now, the way metta is used in the culture. Does anybody not know? Raise your hand if you're new, have not been here before to Seattle Insight. Yes, good. Okay, thank you. So this word metta, which is always wonderful to talk about, means loving kindness. It means the capacity to befriend experiences, to befriend and make space for circumstances and people, hardest people, phenomena, conditions, to come into a different relationship with the conditions in our lives. Metta is engagement. It is the willingness to engage, to not look away, to not disconnect, but to hang in there, come what may, and engage. It's a responsiveness and a connectedness. With metta, we are willing to connect. And we are willing, and this is sometimes takes so much courage and daring, but we are at least idealistically willing to be intimate instead of to turn away. As Thich Nhat Hanh says, learning to see all things with understanding and love. Understanding meaning that whatever is happening is because of causes and conditions, some of which we know and can see and can influence and can guide, others that we cannot, that are unconscious to us, that we don't even know about. So everything causes and conditions, and so understanding means opening to the mystery of things and not thinking we can know what we can't know. Not going about life from an arrogant point of view or from the point of view of I should know, I have to know, I could know if I accumulated enough knowledge. But instead, the willingness to look with Dharma understanding. This intimacy so that a deep understanding can arise that brings compassion and allows us to see and view experiences with love. So metta is a kind of warmth. It's the capacity to befriend. It's the willingness to companion, to stay near to stay close to stand near to. That's the engagement part. The disentangling part is equanimity, non-entanglement, an inner balance in the midst of what? In the midst of everything, in the midst of the worldly winds of sometimes gaining and sometimes losing and then sometimes gaining again. We don't know how the winds are going to blow, sometimes being praised and other times being blamed and thinking when we're blamed that we're always going to be blamed. And then that shifting again and turning around and then being praised and then being blamed again, right? Sorrow turning into joy, joy turning into sorrow. and an inner balance in the midst of it all, and the attempt not to land anywhere, not to make anything permanent that is impermanent, which is all phenomena, by the way. So training to be ever more serene, ever more living with an untroubled heart. The Maha Mangala Sutta, the Buddha said, to live in the world with your heart undisturbed by the world. You know? And I feel that to live is to engage. That's what that word means. To live in the world is not just to go through the motions and to be habituated, but to be alive in this world is to engage. When I say engage, you know, I don't even know whether I really am going to talk about the election much. I mean engaging here and now with whatever there is to be engaged with. The person right in front of you is the person to engage with. That is living in this world. It's not to have big ideas about things. It is to take care of what we can take care of to the best of our capacity. To live in the world with your heart undisturbed by the world, it's a big task, and maybe it's an aspiration. But an aspiration, whatever aspirations we have, that's our North Star. We're going to get there if we have a decent, noble aspiration. And certainly to engage in the world with our hearts untroubled by the world, sensitized and in there and connected, this is something that we can reflect on and contemplate and take just one step at a time in this direction of living, of engaging without overwhelm and living with a heart that is troubled. Sometimes we think our hearts should be troubled. If we have a conscience, our hearts are troubled. And I'll get to that in a moment. It is the capacity to pause before falling into extremes, before falling off on one side or another. And I want to read you a little bit from a wonderful Cambodian teacher friend of mine named Maha Gosananda. He says, equanimity means the absence of struggle. One time, a great elephant jumped into a mud hole to cool off. Of course, he got stuck, and the more he struggled, the deeper he sank. Struggling is useless. It only makes things worse. Do not struggle with suffering. Find your own path. This is called taking refuge in the Dharma. The Dharma is the middle path. The Buddha learned that both self-indulgence and self-mortification are extremes, and extremes can never bring happiness. Peace comes only when we stop struggling with opposites. The middle path has no beginning and no end, so we do not need to travel far on the middle path to find peace. The middle path is not only the road to peace, it is also the road of peace. So letting go of the struggle, engaging, but not making the struggles that we find ourselves in worse by struggling against the struggle, miring ourselves in the mud. Metta and equanimity. In one breath, not as two things, but as one thing. Sometimes we find ourselves, maybe we could say that we're caring too much. There's a wonderful line in a T.S. Eliot poem that I read, I don't know, 40-some years ago, that just really jumped out at me. May I teach me how to care and not to care. You know, teach me how to care and not to care. And of course, maybe saying not to care is not quite the best way of putting it. But equanimity is a balance that allows us to hang in there, stay in there, engage without getting as mired in the mud, without getting as stuck, without being as caught, without being as lost, without being as crushed by conditions, without being as overwhelmed. And one law, in a sense, to remember that helps so much with equanimity that we forget time and time again because we are so wired to try to control our circumstances, is that we cannot control much of anything. And so often we cannot control the outcome. Certainly when it comes to the election, we can engage and we can do our best if we are drawn to. But to think that we can control the outcome, never has that ever been so. So relaxing about the outcome allows us to be more energetic and face what is without being as caught up. When we are overly concerned about an outcome that we don't have control over, the weight of the world seems all on our small shoulders. No matter how big your shoulders may be, they're not going to be able to carry the weight of the world. And so we can experience a lot of guilt and a lot of fear and a lot of helplessness. We can find ourselves tight and contracted. We can find ourselves doing everything, even if we're engaged in doing really helpful things, really beneficial things, really good things. We can find ourselves urgent and pressured, irritable and resentful, and it being costly for ourselves, for our own hearts, and certainly, you know, kind of being quite aggravating for those around us as well. Costly for ourselves and costly for others, and maybe not even as effective as we want to be. So stopping, when we recognize this, just stopping. Stopping and seeing if it's possible in just a given moment to relax the body and to relax the mind from its agendas. To breathe, just to take a breath. It's not baby practice to take a breath. It's actually life-giving to take a breath if you've stopped breathing, if you've forgotten to breathe, if you haven't let your breath out in a long time, if you have not exhaled in some time, to allow yourself to exhale and to allow yourself to take another breath in as well. So stopping and relaxing, breathing, which sometimes can bring back a kind of perspective that we have lost because of the intensity of the anxiety and the dread and the fear and the helplessness. To fully feel what is in our bodies. So helpful to have a body because our thoughts are so untrustworthy. But to feel what is happening in the body, if we're anxious, feeling it in the body. If we're angry, feeling it in the body. If we're afraid, if we're experiencing anguish, feeling it in the body. Engaging with our inner realities and seeing if we can actually allow what is happening to be happening, given that it is, and we don't have a choice. Here it is. Can we love it up? Can we engage with what is happening? Rilke has such beautiful instructions. I want to read this to you. Let each impression and each germ of a feeling come to completion wholly in itself, in the dark, in the inexpressible, the unconscious, beyond the reach of one's intelligence, and await with deep humility and patience the birth hour of a new clarity. Well, I think when he says intelligence, he is talking about the intelligence of thinking. And nothing wrong with thinking. But it's not the whole story. It's never going to be the whole story. The intelligence to be found in awareness is something that is actually more reliable and more nourishing. And this deep humility and patience, the birth hour of a new clarity, you know, it sounds kind of dramatic, you know. I mean, he lived in a very dramatic time, a very tumultuous time, and it sounds very big and dramatic, but it means everything. It means now. It means if there is anguish in your heart right now, this is how to practice, is with deep humility and patience. Let each impression and each germ of a feeling come to completion. Wholly feel it, fully feel it, wholly in itself, in the inexpressible, not labeling it or trying to pin it down, beyond the reach of thinking. In stressful times, which we are certainly in right now, we know that there are stress reactions. Most likely we've heard about fighting, fleeing, and freezing many times over. To be attentive to these stress reactions, I think, is very important right now. To be particularly aware of these reactions to stressful situations by fighting or by trying to flee or by freezing. When we are engaging in life beyond our capacities, beyond our capacity to engage without the ground or the bedrock or the foundation being a heart that is untroubled, some degree of calm, some degree of steadiness in the midst of feeling that which is tumultuous. When we are engaging beyond our capacities, we find ourselves fighting. Now, of course, active resistance can be beneficial. You know, I love, and you may too, but I love what John Lewis said about good trouble. You know, it's such a great way of speaking about actively resisting. So, of course, it can be deeply beneficial. However, inner and outer raging is costly. When inwardly we are beset by rage and lost in anger, there's a wisdom to be found in anger. It wakes us up to injustice. It's just that if we keep throwing logs on the fire, we are going to burn ourselves and everyone else up. It is costly to the heart. So that wisdom that initially wakes us up when we get a signal, something is wrong, something is unjust. Nothing wrong with that, not to be judged. When it is added to, this is another story. And of course, when we are raging outwardly, it generally comes back on us. It generally is costly. So learning to care for one's anger. I think of it really as angry Buddha. And I know that sounds like an oxymoron. But the Buddha, having immensity of space and just sitting there, not getting himself in trouble, you know, just sitting there. Of course, you know, what we see is a statue sitting there. But let's just imagine the person, all of us Buddhas sitting here and having an immensity of space, caring for the anger and recognizing that we can experience it, and in experiencing it in the way that I was describing Rilke's instructions, that we don't have to act it out. We don't have to speak it out. We can listen to its initial arising. Something has to be done. And we can stay quiet and patient. And of course, every once in a while, fierce. Every once in a while, but not often, because it can be such a habit. So at times to really practice restraint and feel the sense of urgency within and see if there can be a newfound clarity simply by being willing to sit with the pressure, to sit with the urgency, to rest in the energy itself, not suppressing, not expressing, just being present with it, not judging, not justifying, simply being present with it. We are more than our anger. We just forget that because of tunnel vision, where anger is all that there is. We are always more than our anger. Everyone is actually more than their anger, even though it doesn't always look that way or appear to be that way. So that's fighting. What is it to flee? What might that look like? Fleeing. Well, the news is really painful right now, oftentimes, and so avoiding the news may be a way to flee. Avoiding or limiting one's exposure can be enormously wise, to limit the exposure and to have times of news fasting, you know, when you're on retreat, but not just when you're on retreat, having specific times when you choose to not subject yourself to the news can be a wise thing to get a bit of a break. And as we know, it can be really addictive, and it's so repetitive. So entirely avoiding is disconnecting, and that can be a form of fleeing. Avoiding as well, repetitive, difficult, painful, negative conversations with people can be a wise thing to do, right? When you're having the same conversation over and over again, and it's not illuminating, and nobody is learning anything, you know, and it's just back and forth, to recognize that it can be helpful to take breaks from these conversations as well, instead of getting continually exhausting. At the same time, it can be fleeing, because we need to learn how to talk to each other. We need to learn not just how to talk to each other, we need to learn how to talk with each other. And we need to practice doing that. We need to practice learning, not habitually fleeing in the thought of having a painful, difficult conversation with someone, but instead facing it, practicing, training ourselves to have these kinds of conversations when the theme is difficult. So it's a matter of wisdom in terms of choosing whether to have a difficult conversation or not. It's not like always yes, it's not like always no, but it's not always, you know, yes, 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 or no, 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 right? It's mixing it up, sometimes yes, and sometimes no. So, as part of this study, or maybe another study, there was a survey of Americans' emotional states. This is another study that found that those who are checked out and are fleeing and avoiding and not experiencing at least some concern about the state of the world or the upcoming election, are also not as engaged in beneficial actions. So I offer that to you, you know, I just offer that to you. I think what is being said is that if we have a narrow approach to our practice, a narrow idea about meditation and the teachings of the Buddha, and we only check out, we won't be as connected to others, and we will be trying to live above the fray instead of living with each other, which we have to do. We can't avoid one another. I mean, we can try, and we can avoid one another, and we can try our best to avoid one another. But whether it's kind and wise is a whole nother story. So freezing, the third one, being paralyzed, not knowing what to do, not knowing where to find relief, and being paralyzed because we think we should know what to do, and we think we should know where to find relief, whereas we can't know what to do. There's no recipe around these things. We have to listen, and we have to be patient with ourselves and others, and we have to gently, and yet with determination, find our way. But we're not supposed to know what to do. It doesn't work like that. We can be addicted to the news, but not able to act on our principles. Again, in the recognition of how little control we have, we may be able to engage with greater wholeheartedness, guided by wisdom, and without as much attachment. So, if we over-engage, the result is anxiety and rage. If we check out, we lose our connectedness with each other. We lose our connectedness with humanity, our sense of being in this world together, sharing this world with one another. And we can easily, maybe be too cool and neglect compassion, the beauty, the necessity, the need to care for pain, to care for sorrow, to meet pain and sorrow in ourselves and in others and in this world with care, the capacity to care. It's very different to feel an oversense of responsibility about our kind of things we need to do in life, our families and our friends and people that we're taking care of and the world and, you know, now the election, and to have this incredible responsibility. It's quite different than it is to be responsive. Responsiveness is wisdom and compassion. Responsiveness is not so heavy. Responsiveness has air in it. Responsibility is kind of closed. Responsiveness is now. It's not I should have before now. I've got to at some other moment. It's always a responsiveness, a sensitivity now. And then looking to see what a wise, equanimous engagement might look like for you. Everybody different. Not one thing that everyone has to do. Although I would say that collective action is a tremendous help in terms of alleviating anxiety and the feeling of helplessness. To get together with others who share your principles can be incredibly empowering. So responsive and responding with grace and with buoyancy and with courage. It's an age-old question in spiritual communities, whether we should focus outwardly on healing the world, or whether we should first heal ourselves, whether we should first attend to our own problems and our own torments of heart. And it's never one or the other. Both, right? Both. We can't fragment ourselves in that way, that it's one or the other, because our practice encourages us to act in wise and kind ways. I always think of the Buddha sitting, right? And then I think of the Bodhisattva with the knee up, ready to move, right? Bodhisattva statues have, you know what I mean? They have their knees up, yes. And they're ready to move. They're able to move. The Buddha is in full lotus, hard to move out of that, you know? But the Bodhisattva is able to move and does move in response to the cries in this world. And I would say in response to the joys of this world, the Bodhisattva's right there with us as well. So not to divide, should we do one or the other, but to live with wholeness. Always doing both by living our practice in our daily life. Letting go of grandiose ideas of saving the world and instead engaging in this world that we share. It's a really wonderful African saying, happy to share, happy to bear one another's burdens. That's why we're here. I want to end with a poem I just found by Joy Harjo. It's called Without. The world will keep trudging through time without us. When we lift from the story, contest to fly home, we will be as falling stars to those watching from the edge of grief and heartbreak. Maybe then we will see the design of the two-minded creature and know why half the world fights righteously for greedy masters and the other half is nailing it all back together. Through the smoke of cooking fires, lovers, trysts, and endless human industry. Maybe then, beloved rascal, we will find each other again in the timeless weave of breathing. We will sit under the trees in the shadow of earth sorrows, watch hyenas drink rain, and laugh. Let's just take a moment to make space, to accommodate, to be in our bodies, to be aware, to be present with what is right now. The totality of what is, not to chop it up, not to segment it, not to cut any aspects of yourself off. To meet the fighting with love. To meet the fleeing with engagement, with metta. To meet the freezing with understanding. To practice metta and equanimity, engaging without entanglement. May it be so.